Martin Luther said that the highest or pinnacle part of worship was the preaching of the Word of God, and that's where we turn now. So if you've got your Bible, I invite you to turn to Matthew chapter 5. This is where we have been for quite a while now, and sadly, this is where we will end. This is our last message as we have been going through the Beatitudes, Matthew 5, 1 through 12. Again, we began this at the beginning, somewhere in the middle of lockdown, and then we decided to finish it when we came out of lockdown. And so here we are at the conclusion of the Beatitudes, the eighth and final Beatitude. And if you've been with us the last couple of weeks, this is actually the third message on this eighth and final Beatitude. Let me just read it for us as we begin. Matthew 5, beginning in verse 10. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Now, as I said, this is our third and, Lord willing, final message in the study of these three verses. And if we've gotten anything out of them thus far, I think we've got the big idea, the general gist. And that is that if you are a disciple of Jesus Christ, you're going to face some kind of persecution. Some kind of persecution. Maybe it's social, maybe it's economical, maybe it will be physical sometime soon. That's the point here Jesus is trying to make. Remember, we've said that these Beatitudes are describing the Christian, all of them, from verse 3 down to verse 12. You have to take them all. This isn't a buffet where I'll choose, you know, blessed are the hunger, or I'll choose blessed are the merciful, or I'll choose the blessed are the peacemakers and leave the others out. You have to take them all. This isn't some kind of a buffet. This is a eight-course meal, so to speak. And persecution of God's people, well, Jesus is stating the obvious, obvious in his statement, but obvious in the history of God's people from the Old Testament to the New Testament to church history to today. As we know, in certain parts of the world, there's persecution, and in fact, we are facing some kind of persecution in our day, in our society. But it's the badge of being a Christian. You need to know that. As Peter said, as we read earlier, it's not some strange thing coming to you. Don't think it's some strange thing that you are going to be persecuted. Expect it. You're not going to rise above your master. Jesus was crucified, the ultimate persecution. You're not going to find anything less. That point, by the way, was made throughout this past week with some of us in our home groups. As I mentioned earlier, we were studying the book of Exodus, and we were in Exodus 1 and Exodus 2, and we were noting how the Hebrews, and as you remember the story, how the Hebrews there in Exodus were so ruthlessly harassed by Pharaoh and the Egyptians. And that point in our study guide took us all the way back to Genesis 3:15, just to make sense of the harassment of the Hebrews. Remember Genesis 3:15? I just remind you of it. Don't turn there. Genesis 3:15, you might say, oh, yeah, that's the first gospel. That's the proto-evangelium. That's where we hear the first announcement of the Messiah. Remember that last part of Genesis 3:15 where God says that the seed of the woman, he will crush the head of the serpent. Ultimate victory. The beginning of that part, however, God says, and he's speaking to Satan, by the way, I will make enemies of you, Satan, and the woman, and of your offspring and her offspring. Or you might know it better as, I will put enmity. Remember that? I will put enmity between you, Satan, and your children, and between you and your children, between you and her offspring, her children. In other words, there's a distinction that you can make with every single person that's out in the world. And I think we've said this. If you're not aware of this, this is something you need to come to a realization of. The Bible is clear that there's only two types of people in this world. There's only the children of God and there's the children of the devil. That's it. And the obvious question that I hope you're asking yourself right now, which one am I? But in Genesis 3:15, God says, I, and notice the I will. It's God who's put the enmity there. And the word enmity has the idea of brood hatred, literally in the Hebrew. Brood hatred. In other words, there's going to be this long war, this long battle between the children of God and the children of the devil. There's enmity between them. And obviously in Exodus 1, Exodus 2, you can see that. The children of God had a brood hatred towards them. They were ruthlessly harassed, persecuted by the Egyptians. But the story doesn't end there, right? The brood hatred doesn't end there. You can just keep reading it as you read Exodus, all the way through Israel's history, all the way up to the time of the New Testament, even to today. All of that to say is, and I was reminded of this week, there is no rusty swords on this battlefield. You ever heard that before? That's taken from the title of a book by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. There are no rusty swords on this battlefield. One of my favorite singers, Michael Card, put that to a song. Some of you know I like Michael Card, and I'm an oldie but fuddy-duddy with it. But back in 1981, Michael Card wrote a song based on no rusty swords. And I won't sing it. I'll just tell you what the lines say. He says, "Don't you know that the battle's raging and you got to join the fight? There's an army of the darkness and an army of the light. There's a side that fights for Satan and a side that's for the Lord. And on this battlefield, there are no rusty swords. Christ has made the final move, so our side is sure to win. He became like us so we would have a chance to be like him. It seems strange that so many fall back when the victory has been won. You just need to ask yourself which side you're on. There's a fact you need to understand before you join our side. You need to know that when Jesus calls, he bids you come and die. He's invaded Satan's kingdom and he's claiming all his own. When the battle's over, he will lead us home. So don't you know that the battle's raging and you've got to join the fight? There's an army of the darkness and an army of the light. There's a side that fights for Satan and a side that's for the Lord. And on this battlefield, there are no rusty swords. There are no rusty swords. I'm not sure many Christians understand that. There are no rusty swords. That is to say, all swords are being used. Which sword do you have in your hand and which side are you on? That's the question. And as we come to these verses, as we've been saying, this becomes the ultimate test of which side you're on. Because if you're not facing any kind of persecution, you have to ask yourself whether you are in the kingdom or not. It becomes the test, as I said. In fact, this week I was thinking, we get tested all the time, don't we? God tests us with trials. Satan tests us with temptations. And the world tests us with what? Persecution. It's not time to play. Why we're called to be sober-minded and vigilant, watchful, always alert. So all of that to say, as we come now back to our text in these three verses, the big idea is if you're a Christian, you will be persecuted. But let's break that down a bit. And we began discussing this last week. We can break it down into three key points or three features, elements. And the three, let me just give them again up to you, give them to you up front, and then we'll work our way back through them. The first is the reality of persecution. That's just a reality. It's the obviousness of being a Christian. But alongside that, we need to discuss the reward of persecution, and then ultimately the response of persecution. So that's where we're going to jump back into in our outline. The reality of persecution, the reward of persecution, and the response of persecution. Last week we only touched on the reality, and so we're going to quickly summarize and review that and then move on to the reward and to the response. But just backing into these verses, let me just give you just a couple bullet points, a couple principles that summarizes the reality of persecution. And here's how I would put it. Number one, The first principle that emerges clearly from what the Lord tells us here is that a Christian is unlike anyone else. I'm just trying to be simple here. A Christian is unlike anyone else. In fact, not just from these verses, if you go all the way back to verse 3, and you read from verse 3 to 12, and you see all these Beatitudes, and if you're living like this, you will be unlike anybody else, right? And that was Jesus' point. If you're going to be a disciple of mine, you're going to be a light and salt in this world. You're going to have to live differently. As I said, there's only two kinds of people in this world. There's the Christian and there's the non-Christian. And there should be an obviousness of which one you are. 1 John says, the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. By the way, the Bible has different ways of describing the differences, the uniqueness. I'll just remind you, you can be described as those in the kingdom of light and those in the kingdom of darkness. The children of God and children of the devil, as I just mentioned. The wise and the foolish, the sheep and the goats, the wheat and the tares. And then here you have what? The righteous and the wicked, or the righteous and the lawless. In other words, let's get back to fundamentals. What is a Christian, or who is a Christian? A Christian is someone who is what? Someone who's called out, separated out, called to God, called to Christ, separated, justified, adopted, sanctified. I mean, there's a lot you could say there, but just narrowing it down, you can just say that Christians are the separated ones. We're called to be holy as He is holy. That's what holiness means. And in saying that, we're saying that Christians are to be distinct. Christians are to be unique. You could even say peculiar, odd. And we are, or should be. And that's okay. That's okay. But you just need to be prepared, because we're odd, because we're unique, because we're distinct, and because we're peculiar, we are going to be persecuted. You got that. Listen. Listen very carefully. The Christian is not just like everybody else with a slight difference. You say, well, I go to church. That's the difference. Well, that's barely making the minimum. And you can go to church and not be a Christian. No, the Christian is essentially different, completely different. He has a different nature. He has a different. He is a different man. He's a different woman. We've been emphasizing that as well. That the only way you get into the kingdom is by being born again. And once you're being born again, you manifest these beatitudes. So that's the first thing I just want to say by way of review. He is. And she is unlike anybody else. Secondly, a second point or principle that's clear from these verses is that the Christian life is controlled and dominated by Jesus Christ. You got that? Again, you can define a Christian by that. The Lordship of Jesus Christ. He is my Lord. I obey Him. I submit myself to Him, even to death. Again, he's controlled. His whole life is controlled and dominated by Jesus Christ. And in fact, again, this is what makes him different and unique. He has a loyalty and devotion to Jesus Christ. He is concerned to do everything for Him. And this is why you get persecuted, because we're doing it, as the end of verse 11 says, for His sake. Notice Jesus says, for my sake. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely. For what? My sake. Why are they reviling and persecuting you? Because everything you say and everything you do is for Christ. It's for Jesus. He is your Lord. You're living for Him. Remember, Paul told the Romans, we don't live for ourselves. We live for the Lord. So whether we live or whether we die, we're what? We're the Lord's. That's who we are. I mean, you could add to that, by way of reminder, you've been bought with a price. You've been bought with His own life. And what's the upshot of that? What does that mean? Well, it means that we live for Him and thus are happily and gladly and willingly give our lives to Him. He gave His life for us. We give our lives for Him, for His sake. I mean, you think about it. what was Paul's simplest definition of his life? He says, for me to live is what? Christ. Is that your definition? I wake up every morning, I roll out of bed, I put my clothes on, and I head out the door, and today I'm going to live for Christ. Yes, you're going to work, but I'm going to live for Christ at work. I'm going to have lunch with so-and-so, but I'm having lunch for Christ. I'm going to, everything you do, from the beginning of the day to the time you put your head on your pillow, you're living for Christ. Now, somewhere in there, somebody's not going to like that. And so, the reality of persecution is going to come. We are the Lord's, and that separates us from everyone else. But not just separation, just to give you a few words to hang your hat on this morning, not just separation, but opposition. Did you catch that? Not just separation, but we're going to face opposition. That's what defines us as Christians. We're getting to the heart of what a true Christian is. Two words, separation and opposition. Go back to 1 Peter real quick. I was just going to reread it for you, but I thought, no, you need to go back and look at it yourself. Go back to 1 Peter, and we'll do this quickly. Go back to 1 Peter 4 and look at verse 3. Because I don't know if you noticed when I read it earlier, this ties so much into our discussion here in Matthew 5. But in verse 3, Peter says, for we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles. In other words, before you became a Christian, you spent your whole life living for who? For yourself. But when you come to Christ, yourself is dead. You've died to self. Isn't that what he says? Follow me. Die to self and pick up your cross and follow me. That's the deal. You want to follow me? You first need to die to self. And that's what Peter is saying here. We've spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles. When we walked, and notice the past tense here, this is the past. And how did we walk? We walked in lewdness and lust and drunkenness and revelries and drinking parties and abominable idolatries. And what's his point here? He says, this is all in the past. Now, you're saying, well, that's part of my present. Well, you need to examine yourself whether you're in the faith. But this is part of the past. Now it's separation from all that. Now you're the Lord's. That was your past lifetime. This is how you are to walk now. And what does he say? Because of that, verse 4, in regard to these, what was these? That's the lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. In regard to these, they, and who's they? That's the world. They think it's strange. What's strange? That you do not run with them in the same, depending on your translation, flood of wild living. I find that very pointed and very purposeful by Peter. Because when he literally says flood of wild living, what is he thinking of? Where was a flood of wild living? Genesis 6. They're going to think it strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of wild living. And so what are they going to do? Are they just going to leave you alone? Oh, he's a weirdo. Well, they may. But that's not normally where it stops. They're going to do what? They speak evil of you. That's opposition. They slander you. They mock you. Oh, what a goody-two-shoe he or she is. So again, just summarizing, if you have a past life and now you are different, you are unlike the world. And that's because, number two, you are the Lord, submitting yourself to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. That is now your aim, that is now your goal, and you live for Him, you live for His sake. Separation, opposition, they go hand in hand. Okay? And again, if, as we've said before, if you're not receiving any opposition, then perhaps you need to look at your separation. If you're not receiving any opposition, maybe you need to go back and look at your separation. Perhaps there is no real difference between you and the world, and perhaps the reason they don't think you as strange is because you actually are running with them in their same flood of wild living. Now, maybe you're not running at the same speed and the same pace, but you are running with them nevertheless. Or you can say you're not running against them, and that's equally as bad. So, separation and opposition are essentially what Jesus is describing here as the mark of his discipleship. That's the reality of being a person, a Christian. That's the reality of persecution. Which now brings us to the second element of this beatitude. And as I said, we'll call this the reward of persecution. There's the reality of persecution, and now we're going to look at the reward of persecution. Have another look at verses 10 to 12. And particularly at the end of verse 10. Here Jesus gives us a reward or a promise to those who are persecuted. End of verse 10, what does he say? For theirs is what? The kingdom of heaven. And he actually says the same thing in the middle of verse 12. For great is your reward where? In heaven. What's the common denominator? What's the common word between them? What's the reward? You get persecuted, you get what? You get heaven. You get heaven. Now, admittedly, Jesus is very general here, right? Jesus just says, reward in heaven. You say, well, what's the reward? Well, you got to get to heaven to get it. Notice that he says, reward in heaven. So you, in one sense, the reward is heaven, but there's also a reward in heaven. And he says, it's great. Notice that? Your reward is great. So I guess we're back to a basic question again, and that is, why do true disciples of Jesus Christ willingly allow themselves to suffer persecution? Well, there could be a number of things that you might come up with, but here, the reason is because of the reward. Because of the reward. We get heaven, we get God, we get Christ. Again, notice two times at the beginning of verse 10 and at the beginning of verse 11, you have the word what? Blessed. He has to make the point of the blessing it is or the privilege it is to be persecuted. Remember this word, blessed? It's the same word that prefaces every other beatitude. You see it from verse 3 all the way down to verse 11. The first word in each of the verses is blessed. And that's, as we've said, it's the word makarios. Makarios has the idea of full contentment, full satisfaction. It's a state of being joyful, happy. And the fact that he mentions it twice, verse 10 and verse 11, he's basically saying, blessed are those who are persecuted for my sake, and not only are they blessed, but they are doubly blessed. Think about that. Doubly blessed. Peter, again, I don't know if you're still back in 1 Peter 4, I've got a finger in there, but I'll just read it for you. He there said, don't return evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing. Knowing that you were called to this, called to what? You're called to suffer. Why are you called to suffer? So that you may inherit a blessing. That's your reward. In fact, a few verses later, Peter then says, if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. Same idea. We know Peter was here. Jesus is talking to the disciples. He's probably got this in the back of his mind as he writes 1 Peter 4. But that's the promise. That's the reward. You are blessed. Think about that. You say, I'm being persecuted. Well, you're blessed for it. In fact, gives you a bit of assurance, doesn't it? For yours is the kingdom of heaven. You get to go to heaven. I mean, think about it. What's the alternative? If you don't go to heaven, where are you going? Right? You remember Moses in Hebrews 11? I'll just read it for you. I think this is good to tie it in. Moses chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. Why? Why did he give up all that he could have had as the prince in Egypt? For he looked to the reward. That's all the writer of Hebrews says. He saw the reward, he looked to it, and that's what he wanted. Same thing here. And by the way, not just Moses in Hebrews 11, all of them. I mean, one way or another, the writer of Hebrews describes all those hall of faith people there. They desired something better. They desired a heavenly country, a city whose builder and maker is God. Which then, you could say, brings us to another key characteristic of the Christian. Not only does he live in separation, not only does he live with opposition, but get this, He also lives for glorification. You catch that? Let me say that again. The Christian, not only does he live in separation, not only does he live with opposition, but the Christian also lives for glorification. And with regards to the rewards of the persecution, the Christian has set his sights on heaven. Again, Pilgrim's Progress, where was he heading? That's all he wanted. He wanted to head to the celestial city. Number of times when he's tempted to turn back or has people telling him to turn back and how foolish he is to go, what does he do? He puts his hands over his ears and says, I only buy the truth, I only buy the truth, I only buy the truth. Doesn't want to hear it. Now, here's a question. What does a person look like when he has his mind set on going to heaven? I mean, go read Pilgrim's Progress for an illustration of someone who is heading to the celestial city. But I just jotted down a few things. Someone who is heading to heaven, and we've already mentioned a couple of these, but one, his life will be controlled by the thoughts of heaven and of the world to come. He will set his mind and affections on those things above and not on the things below, that is, the things on this world. He will obviously recognize that this world is not his home, but ultimately he's just what? He's passing through. He recognizes he's a stranger. He's a pilgrim. And tie it into this, he obviously knows that with all of that, he's going to get harassed for it. He's going to get persecuted for it. In other words, that's what you're going to get if you set your mind on the things above. If you know that you want to go to heaven and you want to head to the celestial city, you just need to know that that is collision with the world. And collision with the world, it means opposition, and expect harassment. Expect persecution. If you desire to be delivered from this corrupt and evil world, delivered from your corruption and your evil flesh, and you want to say, Maranatha, Lord, come quickly, get me out of here. If you're saying, I want to be with you, Lord, I want have pure worship, I want a complete obedience, I want undivided loyalty, I want a pure heart. If that's what you are saying, on one hand, that's what a person looks like when they want to go to heaven. But on that way, expect opposition. But in that pursuit, you get glorification, you get the reward, and that is what controls you. It controls what you spend your time on, it controls what you spend your money on, it controls who your friends are, wherever you go, how you live. Every aspect of your life is submitted to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. I know some of us say, well, I'll put that under the Lordship of Christ and that under the Lordship of Christ, but no, I love this too much, and I'm not ready to put that over there. Jesus doesn't ask for partial obedience. He doesn't ask just for half of you. He says you come and die, which means all of you. Now, of course, the non-Christian, it goes without saying, is the exact opposite to all of this. He doesn't live for God. He doesn't live for Christ. Remember, Paul puts it, the non-Christian doesn't honor God nor give him thanks. The non-Christian doesn't even give a thought about God. In fact, he takes the truth about God and does what? He suppresses it, Romans 1 says, right? And if he's not living for God, who's he living for? He lives for himself. He lives for himself. He lives for the here and now. He lives for the flesh, lust of his flesh, living for the desires of the flesh and of the mind. I mean, he's just living for himself, party after party after party. Work hard all day so he can spend the money to party. He does everything he cannot. In fact, let me say it this way. He does everything he can. Listen, he does everything he can, and some of you know this now, and some of you know that before you were a Christian, this is how you were. He does everything he can not to think of the world beyond. Before you were a Christian, how often do you actually stop and think about death and where you would go after that? Now, the other day I was thinking, that there's the unbeliever. I think every once in a while, I'll give him credit for that, thinks about death. Because he knows in death there's going to be judgment. Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 3:11 that God has put eternity in the hearts of man. Everybody knows that he is going to live or she is going to live forever. Everybody knows that they're immortal in that sense. But because they love the darkness and they love the sin, they suppress that truth. They sear their conscience. They want to live for themselves. And they don't think about death. But every once in a while it'll pop up. And they'll think about judgment, because Hebrews says what? Is appointed for death unto man once, and then comes what? Judgment. And judgment is in front of who? God. Now you say, well, what do you mean? What do you mean that you think about it every once in a while? Well, I think they think of it because they amass a lot of good works throughout their life, thinking that that's what's going to help them get through the gates, the pearly gates, when they do stand before God. I mean, everybody recognizes they've lied and they've stolen and they've broken a lot of God's commands. But if I can just amass a lot of good stuff, that when I do stand before God and he sees all my bad stuff, I'll have this good stuff here that I'll outweigh the bad stuff, and that's what it's going to take for me to get in heaven. Isn't that most people's thinking? And the Bible says you're not saved by works. You're saved by what? You're saved by grace, through faith, in Christ, alone, alone, alone. Right? But the world, they don't think of that, if they think at all. I mean, why do you think the number one drive in the world, think about it, and we're all guilty of it. The caveat here is, I like watching TV like everybody else. I like watching a movie like everybody else. But my world is not driven by that. My life isn't driven by that. But where does the world ultimately go to bury every thought of judgment or every problem or every time there's a pang in their conscience? Where do they go to drown it? Well, they drown it in alcohol, they drown it in drugs, they drown it in partying, or they just turn on the TV or watch a movie, or music for that matter. Entertainment, let's just leave it at that, right? The number one drive in the world for pleasure seeking, entertainment, amusement, they don't want to think about death. They don't want to think what comes after death. And as I said, they just drown themselves so those thoughts don't come. Eat, drink, and be merry, they say. Live for today. Don't worry about tomorrow. Now, you got that type of person, and then you got this person that lives for Jesus Christ, that doesn't live for themselves, they don't live for today, and they live for heaven. Will there be an obviousness between those two people? Will there be a uniqueness, a distinction, a separation? There better be. You're going to have two different people with two different outlooks, with two different worldviews, and two different ethics. Jesus says, though, ultimately those two people will collide. Those two people will collide. Yes, there's separation, but there's also going to be what? Opposition. For the Christian, the outcome is what? Heaven. Isn't that good? The reward is heaven. For the non-Christian, again, what's the alternative? Not heaven. And we're not annihilationists. We don't believe they're just going to evaporate. The Bible's very clear, there is a hell. Eternal torment. Under the wrath of God, in the presence of God, under his wrath, in his unfavorable presence, however you want to word it, forever and ever and ever. I've said this before, I'll say it again. The difference between heaven and hell is that one has a mediator. Did you get that? Before you stand before God, you better come with a mediator. You better come with a savior. And by the way, just as our reward is heaven and that's great, their reward is hell and that's great as well. In other words, you come back to the text here. When you look at verses 11 and 12, there's a you and there's a they, right? You see that? You, they. And we noted last week that verse 10 is like all the other Beatitudes where Jesus says, blessed are those. But when he comes into verse 11 and 12, he changes the person into you, from third person to second person. He's talking about the disciples here. You. They. I mean, you long for Christ. You live for Christ. You live to be like Christ. And they are going to hate you for it. They're going to persecute you for it. So on one hand, that's the reality of persecution. On the other hand, that's the reward of persecution. And they go hand in hand. They go side by side. So let's just sum up this point before we move on. Why do Christ's disciples gladly and willingly let themselves suffer harassment from the world? Why is persecution a blessing? It's because of the reward or rewards. Verse 11, it identifies us with Christ himself. See that? My sake? What's he saying there? He's pointing to our solidarity with him. Did he suffer? Yes. We share in his sufferings. And that's a privilege. You remember the apostles in Acts 5, after they were beaten, they departed rejoicing that they were counted worthy, what? To suffer shame for his name. And again, it's the same point here. Jesus says, persecution comes for my name's sake. And then look at the end of verse 12. You're going to be persecuted. You're going to be like me, Jesus says, but you're also going to be like who? The prophets. They persecuted the prophets also. I mean, how would you like to be counted with men such as Abel, Noah, Samuel, Elijah, Elisha, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, just to name a few? That's quite a company, isn't it? I mean, how would you like to be part of that group? The prophets. What's a prophet? A prophet is someone who is sent by God to speak for God. That's all of us. And in a sense, we are prophets. We speak for God. And if you get persecuted, you're just like the prophets of old. And as I said, that's an illustrious company there. You're God's peacemaker, just to connect it back up to verse 9. But you need to remember there's a cost with it. There's a cost with it. And end of verse 12, for so they, what, persecuted the prophets who were before you. Yes, you are persecuted, but look at the company you keep. Isn't that good? I mean, we know how privileged the prophets were. We know how they were approved and blessed by God. Why does Jesus, by the way, include the prophets here? Well, why does he add the prophets here? I mean, you think he would have said enough in verse 10, but then he adds 11, but then he adds verse 12. Well, I think his point here is you're part of this family line that ultimately, as we said earlier, goes all the way back to Genesis 3:15. Because the first prophet that was killed was who? Abel. And there's this long line of prophets that are killed, persecuted. And you're part of that line. And being part of that line is a what? That's a blessing. That's a blessing. And it's a blessing because not only you are in a state of blessing, but it also gives you the assurance that you are aware you're in the kingdom. This is the whole point. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Your reward is in heaven. So you live this separated life and you receive this opposition and you realize that the whole goal of it is to go to heaven and get your reward. That immediately should give you what? Assurance. Right? The kingdom of heaven is only for the persecuted, if you want to summarize it in a soundbite. I mean, if you're persecuted in your workplace because you refuse to join in the gossip or the character assassination or the dodgy jokes and they exclude you or gang up on you because you are a Christian, you are to accept it with joy. You got that? You accept it with joy. Why? Because it proves something. And what does it prove? It proves that you're in the kingdom. I mean, if you're at home or with friends and they insult you or despise you, not because you're difficult or obnoxious, right? But because of Christ, well, what does that prove? That proves that you are in the kingdom. If you are sharing the gospel and the only reaction is hostility or mockery and you receive it cheerfully, again, that proves you are in the kingdom. I don't know how else that can be taken than an encouragement. Persecution brings reward. Sure, there's a reward in heaven, but there's reward here What is that? You're blessed. You're blessed. But it also brings heaven. It brings Christ. It brings association. You're in line with the prophets. It brings assurance of salvation. The assurance that the kingdom of heaven is ours. So that's the reward of persecution. We've looked at that. The reality, what's left? One more, and we'll be quick with this. The response of persecution. Jesus addresses that here. The response of persecution. I mean, as we said, persecution is inevitable. And if it's inevitable, we better be prepared how to face it. And so the question comes, how do we respond to it? And look, we could spend a lot of time on this, and maybe we will in weeks to come, because there are some specific ways of responding to it. I mean, we could talk about not returning evil for evil, not reviling for reviling, not feeling resentment, not getting depressed. We could also talk about turning the other cheek, as he'll say a little bit later in chapter 6. We could talk about long-suffering, being patient, being strong, being courageous, praying for our persecutors. There's a lot of responses, right? Now, what does Jesus say here? He actually gives a command. Look at verse 12. This is how we're to respond to persecution. It's the only command in all the Beatitudes, and what is it? Rejoice and be exceedingly glad. Do you get that? You see that? That's the response. What is your response to all the reviling, the slandering, the mocking? Rejoice and be exceedingly glad. That was the apostles, Acts 5. They went away rejoicing. And that's the common pattern we see throughout the book of Acts, all through church history. Tons of examples. You'll find believers singing, praising, rejoicing. And by the way, rejoice here means to enjoy a state of happiness and well-being, right? But why does he add be glad? Well, be glad is similar in meaning, but it's more intensive. The word here he speaks of is, in a sense, overjoyed. Rejoice, but be overjoyed. Or extremely joyful, or exceedingly glad. That's the point here. That's your response. I mean, it's like when you burst into a song or to a skip or a dance. I mean, there's something just pops in your head and you're excited about it and you just kind of skip or burst into a song and sing about it. That's what he's saying here. You're overwhelmed with joy. Really? I just got spat upon. I just got my hair pulled out. I just got flogged and all the above, and I'm to rejoice and be exceedingly glad? That's what Jesus says. And I know it sounds strange, but the point is celebration. Celebration accompanies persecution for the believer. That's the response, he says. I mean, think about it. I mean, let's really think about it. We've already said that persecution assures us of the kingdom. We said that persecution proves that we are in the kingdom. We said that persecution shows that our names are indeed written in the book of life. We said that persecution means that we will inherit an eternal reward that is promised. All of that, what's our response? Rejoicing in gladness. In other words, don't look at the persecution. Look what's beyond the persecution. Rejoice and be glad. It demonstrates what team we're playing for. And you better know what team you're playing for. There's only two teams. So if there is separation, if there is opposition, and there's a desire for glorification, and when the persecution comes, there is celebration, that's a telltale what team you're on. You're on Christ's team. And that's the winning team, by the way. We celebrate because we know that the victory's already been won. All we're waiting for is what? The consummation. So again, if they hurl verbal abuses at you, and if they get into your face and insult you, if they spit upon you, they hurt you. And listen, even if they kill you, I said this the other day, the worst thing they could do for you is what? The best thing for you. Because when you're dead, where are you? You're merely in the presence of God, and then you've got your reward. Remember, Paul said the sufferings of this life pale in comparison to the glory that awaits us in heaven. So rejoice and be exceedingly glad. Jesus' command. So, again, what have we seen? As I said, we've seen separation, opposition, glorification, and now celebration. These are the key marks of being a disciple of Jesus Christ. And that's a good way of summing up these eight Beatitudes. I mean, you go all the way back up to verse 3 and you begin on this path of separation and glorification, ultimately to verse 10, where you will face some opposition and persecution. Your response is what? Celebration. And by the way, let me just add, if your response isn't celebration, what's the alternative? Potentially. Think of the book of Hebrews. Well, that letter was written because there was a group of people, Jewish Christians, that were facing severe persecution. Persecution from the state, from the emperor, persecution from families. I mean, some of you know, when you turn to Christianity, where your family is Orthodox or Catholic or Muslim, you're going to face persecution from your family. They're not going to take that well. That's shame. And that's what you had in the book of Hebrews. It didn't look like they were celebrating, does it? So what's the opposite of celebrating? If it's not celebration, it's what? Defection. Right? Or desertion. And that ties into the parable of the sower in Matthew 13. The seed that falls on stony soil, where tribulation arises, persecution arises. And Jesus says it arises because of the word. But there was no root. The persecution was too much, so they fall away. There's no celebration but rejection. There's no love and loyalty to Jesus Christ, but a love and affection for the world. Some of you know people like that. Remember, in the Bible, there's Demas, who loved this present world. It was just went as long and far as he could, but at the end, his true colors were revealed. I just love this world too much. There's people like that. There's people in the church like this. We've seen over the years people that come in, and they seem hot for the Lord and zealous for the Lord, and tribulations come, trouble comes, and it was just too much for them, and they went back. So as we close, and before we come to the Lord's table, let me just give you one final thought. And I want you to get this. This is important. It's not just persecution. Okay? Make sure you get everything that Jesus is here. And I'm hoping that I'm clear in this. It's not just persecution, but it's the right response to persecution that makes you a true disciple of Jesus Christ. You got that? You just can't say, well, there's the reality of persecution, but I don't have the right response to persecution. No, you got to take it all. Someone has well said of the Christian that faith makes a Christian, life proves a Christian, trial confirms a Christian, death crowns a Christian. I think that's good. Spurgeon, our favorite Baptist preacher, likewise says, "You are in the true prophetic succession if you cheerfully bear reproach of this kind for Christ's sake. You prove that you have the stamp and seal of those who are in the service of God." End quote. That's good. I think it's a good place to conclude the reality of persecution, the reward of persecution, and the response of persecution. Again, it's all about and all part of being a loyal and devoted follower of the Lord Jesus Christ. And so before we go to the Lord's table, we have to ask this as it relates to these three verses. Do they describe you? And as we've been asking throughout this whole study, do all of these Beatitudes describe you? Not the perfection. Still what? The direction. Is this your desire? I want to be a peacemaker. I want to hunger and thirst after righteousness. I want to be merciful. I mean, you just go right through them all. This is my desire. Now, may the Lord search our hearts and reveal our true character and help us to be what Christ wants us to be. Father, we thank